This call is being recorded.
Hi, my name is John Richardson. Today is Thursday, April the 30th, and I'm speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. And joining me in this call is a star-studded cast of people. I am starting just in the direction of what I see on my screen. Karen Alpert is joining us from Australia. Laura Snyder is joining us from France. David Johnston is joining us also from France. And finally, to round it out, Keith Redman is joining us from the Washington, D.C. area. And we have come together today to have a group discussion about a topic that is of great interest, causes a great deal of anxiety, and takes up a lot of time thinking about. And this is the problem of how those who are defined as U.S. citizens living outside the United States should respond to the twin pressures, the first pressure being coming from the United States to file U.S. tax returns based on their U.S. citizenship. And I suppose the second pressure is coming particularly in countries like France from the banks who are saying, if you're born in the United States, you better give us a Social Security number or we're going to run interference with your banking privileges. There are a number of different type of people who worry about this. They have very different kinds of situations. Their responses to this certainly should not, cannot, and would not be a one-size-fits-all. And today, the purpose is to try to talk about different situations for different types of people and see how we can help people think about this problem. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining me. And I think what I'd like to do is kind of just punt this over to our friend Keith Redman to begin zeroing in on what he thinks the right questions would be to ask. Keith?
Sure. Well, thank you, John, for the invitation to this podcast, because I think it's a very important one. I know for me, I deal with a number of individuals, whether they be Americans living overseas or what has been deemed as accidental Americans, who have never been in the U.S. tax system. That's kind of the common thread with the people who reach out to me. And the questions are, regardless of what their profile may be, the questions tend to be quite similar. Should they enter the U.S. tax system? Should they stay away? Should they enter the U.S. tax system to renounce? Should they not enter the U.S. tax system to renounce? What is the right answer? And also, what program should they enter if they do decide? Is it streamlined? Is it the new IRS program? Should they wait to see if maybe another program comes into existence? Should they wait to see if the U.S. changes its way of taxation? These are a variety of similar questions that I get. And this ranges from people who have a very basic, simple financial profile to others who have been overseas, meaning living outside the United States for a long time, where they have more of a complex type of profile. So this is a big question mark that I get quite a bit. And as you stated, there really is no cookie cutter approach, hence the reason why this discussion would be a good one for people to hear.
My God, Keith, so, your way of making it sound so simple. I can hardly believe how few issues you've illuminated in that answer.
Well, I'm trying to keep it simple as best I can.
Good for you. Well, a couple of things. Just focus in on what you said at the beginning. You talked about two kinds of people. What they all have in common is that they seem to not be in the U.S. tax system, but you talked about two kinds of people. One, accidental Americans, and the others, I understand, to be just U.S. citizens who didn't know they had to file taxes. Are those the two groups?
Yes, U.S. citizens who maybe have left the United States many years ago, never filed, or U.S. citizens who have never lived in the United States and have never filed.
The latter would be the how would you define an accidental? You use the phrase accidental. I'm wondering if we can get some agreement on that.
Yeah, well, if I go by the term accidental American that Fabien Lahagre uses with his Association of Accidental Americans in France, I believe there are two categories. One is an individual who was born in the United States to non-Americans for whatever reason and left the United States, literally in diapers, and moved back to the country of their parents, whether that be France, Germany, Japan, wherever. And they have never had a U.S. passport, never had a Social Security number. They've moved forward with their life in France, wherever. Many of those people don't even speak English, for example. That's one bucket of accidental Americans. Another bucket of accidents.
Can I ask you this? Do these people consider themselves to be Americans, or are they just responding to what I would call the accusation of American citizenship?
It's the latter. They're responding to the accusation of being American. They don't consider themselves American.
And they do not consider the offer, the good news of their being an American to be something they would like to pick up on? They do not want to be Americans?
Well, some of them kind of knew that maybe they were American because they were born in the U.S. Others had no clue whatsoever. It wasn't until the implementation of FATCA where it was brought to their, to the forefront of their situation. So you have some who were knowledgeable about it and others who had no clue whatsoever, had no idea.
But even the ones who are knowledgeable about their U.S. citizenship, would it be fair to say they had no knowledge of U.S. tax obligations?
That is correct. They had no knowledge. And there's no reason for them to even have the knowledge. Correct.
Right. Okay.
And then you have another bucket of accidental Americans are those individuals who were born outside the United States to one or possibly two American parents. And they are deemed, based on certain criteria, as Americans. But they've never lived in the United States. They don't have any ties to the United States. The only American tie they have is to maybe one or possibly two American parents, whether they be in France, Germany, Japan, etc. So those are those two buckets, if you will.
Okay, so those would be the accidentals. And the other group you were talking about were Americans who left the United States some years ago. How would you describe
your exactly? Situation? Yeah, they could be somebody who moved overseas right after high school to study abroad, and they fell in love and they stayed abroad. So they never even worked in the United States. They've been spending their adult life overseas. Or somebody who went over with, let's say, a job that they got when they were in their 20s and now they're in their 60s and they had no idea that they were supposed to file U.S. taxes.
What all these people have in common, though, the way you're describing it, is they're people who live in France. They're tax residents of France. They are not tax residents of the United States. But yet somehow or other, they're supposed to be taxable by the United States on their worldwide income, including income earned
Correct.
In France. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Okay. Now, Karen, would this be more, would Keith's description apply to the people who you've worked with in Australia as well?
Well, many of the people who contact me in Australia would be in one of those categories. I hear from many accidentals who were born in the U.S. while their parents were studying or working, and then moved back to Australia very young. I also hear from people who immigrated from the U.S. to Australia decades ago. I mean, back in the 70s, you'd go to you'd ask whether you were supposed to file a tax return, and a lot of the consulates would tell them, no, you don't need to worry about that. Your income is below the earned income exclusion. No need. And they got that answer 30 or 40 years ago and figured, okay, that's good. Not gonna worry about it. And then life moves on. The U.S. changes. Well, the U.S. really hasn't changed anything. It's just that people's understanding of what the obligation is and people's the level of enforcement, especially with FATCA, has really ramped up so that people who could have not filed in the past that now they're feeling pressure to file because of FATCA.
And this pressure is coming from a variety of sources, but most notably non-U.S. banks. Would that be correct?
Well, so the bank's telling them that they need to give the bank a social security number. And so then they start looking into it, and the advice on the consulate websites and everything is you've got this obligation. I mean, that's been the case for you know, as long as I've been in Australia, but wasn't necessarily the case in the 70s and 80s. So they start looking at, okay, I've got to give them my social security number. What does that mean? And they conclude that it means they have to file taxes. And I'm not sure that the one follows the other necessarily, but certainly legally under U.S. law, they are required to file. And
but Karen, what about and Keith or anybody? But what about you know, you speak of Americans who left the United States 40 years ago.
Yeah,
a lot of those people became Australian citizens years ago.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How does that play into this whole thing?
Well, as far as the U.S. is concerned, as long as you're a U.S. citizen, you still have to file.
Okay, but
right.
Isn't it the case that becoming a citizen of another country, with the intention of relinquishing U.S. citizenship?
But none of them would have had an intention of relinquishing their U.S. citizenship, or few of them would have.
But the ones who did have that intention presumably could make the case that they're not U.S. tax residents. Is that correct?
They could. They could make the case that they're no longer U.S. citizens.
Okay, so that's another complicating factor. And as I understand the law on that, the cutoff date would be June 3rd, 2004. But the ones who lost U.S. citizenship for nationality purposes prior to June 3rd, 2004 would not currently be U.S. tax citizens, I think is the answer on that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then what happens is, so we have FATCA and the banks get the Social Security number. They start doing a bit of research. They have this, what's referred to as this, oh my God, moment. And then what they often do is they call up a tax person, I guess, right?
And 9 times out of 10, they call up a CPA who's in the U.S. tax compliance industry. And that's when they find out from that particular CPA that they must and they are obliged to file U.S. declaration and pay any monies owed to the U.S.
Okay. So what's happening then is sort of a combination of pressures coming from the banks, the stuff they read online, and conversations they have with various tax professionals. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I would add to that that they might also post questions on social media, and they'll get a fair number of people telling them it's the law, you need to file, period.
Okay, well, I think why don't we ask the question, is it the law?
Well, it's U.S. law, but it's not French law or Australian law or Canadian law, but it's okay. U.S. law.
So in other words, it's the United States imposing a law on people who don't live in the United States but live somewhere else. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Aren't there treaties that deal with this type of situation, or at least attempt to deal with this? What are your thoughts on that, Karen?
Oh, definitely there's treaties out there. A lot of them are inadequate. But what they don't do, so if you're not a U.S. citizen, so say you're an Australian who moves over into the U.S., then the treaty is going to have a tiebreaker that's going to say either the U.S. or Australia gets to treat you as a resident. but the U.S. has carved out their citizens from that tiebreaker. So U.S. citizens can't use the treaty to say, oh, but I'm a tax resident of Australia, I shouldn't be also a tax resident of the U.S.
And that's because of a specific provision of the treaty called the saving clause that basically, in the case of Australia, for example, Australia agrees that the United States can impose worldwide taxation on Australian residents who are also U.S. citizens. Is that correct?
Right. And you know, it's interesting when you start talking to Australian politicians about that. It's like, well, of course the U.S. can tax Americans. But as you said earlier, a lot of these people don't identify as Americans. They identify as Australians.
Well, but, and they're Australian citizens living in Australia, right?
They're Australian citizens living in Australia. Many of the accidentals don't identify as American at all. But the treaty says that if the U.S. wants to call them American, then the U.S. can write whatever rules they want about their taxes.
Right.
Now, let me add something to this, Stu, and this could be linked to the savings clause or not. And, John, this is where your expertise would come into play, because I've actually have spoken and met with key countries' tax authorities in Europe over the years. And, again, I'll use France because I'm tied to France as an example, where we met with the tax authorities. And where Fabien Lagre, whom I met, actually got a letter from them stating that they will not do the bidding of the IRS of collecting any type of tax debt if that individual was a citizen of France at the time the tax debt was incurred. They will not do it. So that adds to the stew of enforcement or non-enforcement.
Right. Okay. So now on that point, that is going back to the tax treaty. That's actually, I think, what the U.S.-France tax treaty says and the U.S.-Canada tax treaty in Denmark and Sweden. Right. So in other words.
If I may add also, I know you're talking about those specific countries, because they have the, if I'm not mistaken, the mutual assistance agreement. But I've also spoken with tax authorities in countries that don't have that, and they've stated the same thing. So I don't know if that makes a difference or not, but I wanted to put that on the table.
Sure, sure. Well, okay. So now, just to be clear on the direction the conversation is going right now, I think we should be very, very clear that when a country like France says they will not enforce a U.S. tax debt, they're just saying that they won't help enforce it. That doesn't mean there's no U.S. tax debt from a U.S. perspective. Would you agree
Correct.
With that? Okay. Correct. Karen, would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So it does seem to, I do think that that treaty provision in France, Canada, et cetera, that specifically says that, I think it's definitely helpful. But I do think that it's important that we be clear that it doesn't mean there's no U.S. tax debt. It does seem to me, I think I would be right in saying that it is, at this point in time at least, and I think for the foreseeable future, very difficult for the U.S. to enforce a U.S. tax debt outside the United States. Is there anybody who would disagree with that?
Certainly with regard to assets held outside of the United States, the U.S. has very little ability to enforce its tax debts.
Okay. Correct.
But there is still the tax debt, you know, kind of floating around there. And it seems to me, and I'd be interested in everybody else's view on that, it seems to me that the U.S. tax debt is the, you know, the foundational thing that causes all the problems here, or that can cause all the problems. So if there were no U.S. tax debt, there could be no problem at all, right?
Well, certainly if there were no U.S. tax on non-resident citizens, there wouldn't be a problem.
Okay.
But I'm not sure if that's where you're going with this.
Well, I'm just trying to make the distinction between the existence of the tax debt and the enforceability of it, or the likelihood of enforceability. That's all I'm trying to do.
Okay.
Okay.
I think the only problem with not having a U.S. tax debt, if one can consider it a problem, is that the only way one will know if they don't have a U.S. tax debt is by doing the compliance with the U.S. system to find out if they have a U.S. tax debt or not. And there's a cost involved there.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily true, Keith. I mean, I think it's entirely possible. Well, I think it's entirely possible for people to, you know, analyze or get their situation analyzed to see whether they would owe any U.S. tax. I mean, there is a group of people who don't file but would not owe any U.S. tax debts. So there are no U.S. tax debts, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, right.
And I think that that's, you know, that's a nuance to this that I think is important. So somebody doesn't file, there are penalties for information returns if they were required on, you know, for small business corporations and stuff like that. But let's just say that you're a basic employee and, you know, you don't have much or anything in the way of investments. Let's say that the only income you have is from salary. Let's say it's below the earned income exclusion amount, the $102,000 US or whatever, then it may be that you don't file, but you clearly don't owe them anything either, do you?
Right.
But there is a requirement to file, right? So, you know, there's, you know, that's another aspect to this. Okay. Now, one of the things in the years that I have spent trying to help people through and out of this situation is that for many people, particularly high level intelligence people, this is a terrifying situation because they think of themselves as honest, law abiding people who are 110% tax compliant in their country of residence. They've made it a priority to be tax compliant. They're proud of it. Then all of a sudden their world gets turned upside down by this, oh my God, you know, not only should you have been filing U.S. tax returns, but hey, you've got a small business corporation, so, you know, you may have some tax owing and stuff like that. Now, I'm presuming that Keith, Karen, everybody on this call has encountered lots of people whose lives have been turned completely upside down by this. Agreed?
Yeah.
Or they're afraid that their lives are going to be turned completely upside down. Yes, I agree.
I think the fear is often worse than the actuality. But
I think
it's the fear that turns their lives upside down.
Yeah, and I talk to lots of people who said they can't sleep. They're just so worried about this.
And, you know, the reason that they're so fearful, or one of the reasons, is the difficulty in getting clear answers to questions, right?
That is correct.
You know, there's so much floating around. So people are scared because of uncertainty. And one of the things that I have observed many times is that because people are so terrified and the uncertainty fuels it, that what they'll often do is just file a bunch of U.S. tax returns, pay a whack of U.S. tax in many cases, because they'd rather have the certainty of giving all their money to the IRS than the uncertainty of noncompliance. You know, I've certainly seen a great deal of that. Have you seen that?
I have
seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would like to throw, and forgive me, because I still think this is on topic, I'd like to throw another dynamic into the mix here that I think is important to just, again, put on the table. If you take a look at the numbers that are out there of Americans living outside the U.S., whether it be the U.S. State Department figure of 9 million or the Federal Voters Assistance Program, where they have a figure of either 5 or 6 million eligible voters living outside the United States, the vast majority of those people are not even in the U.S. tax system. So how is that brought into this dynamic on whether someone should be filing or not? Does that question make sense? Meaning if you look at the whole pie and there's only one sliver that actually is in the system, what about the rest of the pie where they're not even in the system? Does that play into any decision-making process?
Well, I think that when people observe that, I think that it probably makes them wonder whether they should file, because so many people don't file. That's my guess. I don't know. Karen, what do you think about that?
Well, certainly, I think it does. And it brings up the issue of, why don't we just try and fly under the radar, since so many people are flying under the radar?
Go ahead.
You might recall that, I did a survey of 600 Americans that we published about 7 months ago. And I can tell you, so people who responded to the survey gave a lot of comments, and the comments have really ran the gamut of the different types of reactions that you've just been talking about. People saying that they were, when they learned about their obligations, they were shocked, they were sleepless, they were torn up about what the implications were for their U.S. citizen children that they had, registered at the consulate. Also, people who responded to the survey who said, I don't have any problems because I don't file. I'm not in the system, so I don't have any problems. But I can confirm that the people who responded to that survey, a very small minority of the people that responded to that survey said that they did not have serious problems because they were U.S. citizens living outside of the U.S. They didn't have serious problems due to the taxation and banking issues. Go ahead.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know if they were filing properly. I assume you're referring to people who file.
I think very few are filing properly.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
When I said they had serious problems, I don't mean necessarily that the IRS was on their back. I meant psychologically. I mean, maybe the IRS at one point was on their back, and some people did talk about how they were fine. But what I meant was psychologically how they lived the experience. Used very strong words, there were many who said that their feelings about the United States completely changed as they grew to learn what it meant to be an American living outside the United States.
John, since we're starting to talk about personal stories, does it make sense for me to, this is David speaking here, to chip in with mine?
Absolutely, it does. Please do.
Okay, so in a nutshell, I've been living in France. My name is David Johnstone. I've been living in France for nearly 20 years. For the last 15 years, all of my income has been in France. So no U.S. income, never owed any U.S. taxes, but filed for a while. And then I got a long-term illness. I was on long-term sick leave. And then since 2015, I've been on full disability. So in my case, I have to literally choose between filing U.S. taxes every year and possibly recovering to the point of being able to work again. So for me, the biggest difficulty for me is the actual tax filing. I have some of the issues that other people talk about with banking issues and so forth. But the biggest thing is the time and energy and complexity of the annual tax filing. And I wonder whether it's not better. Well, for health wise, it would be better for me to stop filing again. I had made a filing after not having filed for several years. I made a reasonable cause.
You came into compliance.
I came into compliance.
It's a bad filing.
Whatever. And I knew, because I was born abroad, I knew about the filing requirement, because my father had actually been audited twice in the 70s in Cyprus. So there's I guess maybe in Australia the consulate was saying one thing, but in Cyprus the consulate was definitely promoting compliance. So I knew about that. So I know probably from family experience a little bit more than most that the IRS can, in some cases, make your life a little bit miserable, even if you're living outside the U.S.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that tax compliance people and lawyers can make your life miserable, just by trying to read the law to you. But I think that the person who can make you the most miserable is probably yourself, depending on, how wired you are with it.
Right. I personally came back in because I was feeling better, and I thought, well, I should do this now rather than later, because FATCA was coming into into force in France, and I thought, well, I should do it now. With hindsight, I probably should have waited until I had the energy to speak with somebody, a professional, to find out how to do things a little bit better. But, hindsight is 20/20.
Right. Now, can I, I'm not looking for you to answer this question, but listening to you talk, David, the question that runs through my mind is, why don't you just renounce U.S. citizenship and get rid of the problem that way?
Well, I have two reasons why I don't renounce and I can't renounce. One is that I don't have a second citizenship yet.
I see.
Second is that, three, I guess. Second is that my family lives in the U.S., and so I expect an inheritance, which will come from the U.S. So I'm not sure that it will make sense for me to renounce, at least before that's taken care of. And also, I don't have any children, so anybody who got money from me would be a U.S. citizen. So there's that. And then,
I understand.
Right. And then if my health deteriorates to the point that I have to go back and live with family, then I would like to have that possibility of being able to actually go back and living with the family.
John.
Yes.
I know that people think that that's a reasonable question. Why don't you announce? I think that's a completely unreasonable question and an unreasonable expectation. Why should someone have to renounce their citizenship for this? Citizenship is not just for many people, not for everyone, part of who they are. Citizenship is a human right. I don't understand how these things can be equated, and I don't understand how renouncing your citizenship is considered a reasonable solution to this.
I agree with you completely. Laura, focusing on the language that you use, which either was either the force to renounce or, some equivalent to that. I don't think anybody should be forced to renounce citizenship because of this. But my observation was more along the line that not being an American would solve the problem. And there certainly are an awful lot of people who do not want to be American. That's their choice. That's not...
I'm not so sure about that. Maybe they just see that that's the only way to get out of the problems that they're in. And I think what they really want is to not have these problems. Fundamentally, do they really not want to be American? I'm sure there are people that don't want to be. I'm sure that number compared to the total number of people who are announced is very small. And I think if you look at the testimonies of the people who have renounced, and when they explain how they felt about it, some of them admittedly were quite happy and felt free. Many of them felt terrible about it, cried. They said they vomited. You know, they were shaking. So I think that those are really, obvious signs that they don't want to not be American. They want to solve their tax and banking problems, and they don't see another way to do it.
So to be clear, what you're saying is that a lot of people renouncing are doing it because they feel forced to. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And they would say that they felt forced to in those very words.
Okay. You know,
I'd agree with that.
In 1967, yeah. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision in Aforium versus Rusk, which was probably the most single important citizenship decision in the last century. And what the court said was that Congress could not do things that would result in the forcible destruction of U.S. citizenship. And what you're describing, what Karen is agreeing with, and I think Keith is agreeing with, and I certainly would agree with, that I believe that people are being forced to renounce. Now, they may be happy about it, okay, you know, or they may not feel they're losing a lot. I mean, I think that some do and some don't. But I do agree with you that this, you know, to use the language of the court, that this is the forcible destruction of citizenship.
And John, this is not just a violation of, you know, that court decision and whatever rights might be under that court decision, but this citizenship and the right to have your citizenship is reflected in a number of international treaties, some of which the United States has signed. So this is much larger than U.S. law. This is international law.
You know, I agree with you on both points. And I think that you make a very, very important point that as a matter of international law, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which it's interesting how these were tied actually to different wars, right? Which was a post-World War II.
Yeah.
Human rights document basically seems to me does give, it certainly recognizes citizenship as a human right and seems to me give some protection. And then as a matter of domestic U.S. constitutional law, we've also got that. Yet, the pressure for Americans to renounce is enormous. I do think they're being forced to renounce.
There's no question. Of course they are.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, this is our perspective from living outside the United States. My sense of this is that people inside the United States cannot even begin to comprehend this. Would you agree?
Of course.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I do agree.
Yeah. So I want to pick up on one other thing that David said. He said that he didn't want to renounce because he was expecting an inheritance. And I think that in many cases, it might actually be easier to be a non-resident alien inheriting U.S. assets than to be, well, certainly more easier than being a non-compliant U.S. citizen when inheriting U.S. assets. What would you say to that, John?
That's an interesting point, Karen.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think it depends on the country they're in and what the treaty may be. Now, I know that this is something that, Karen, that you put a lot of thought into. And basically, one of the issues is simply the basis of the assets that you're inheriting, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's one. And there are others. I suspect that in David's case, U.S. citizenship might, in his case, be an advantage if he's a tax resident of France on the inheritance. There are certain countries where there's an advantage to being a U.S. citizen. I believe Ireland is one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, France is one as well.
I'm thinking in terms, though, of the U.S. tax, because if an estate distributes money, you know, assets or income to a U.S. citizen, the IRS is going to expect a U.S. tax return.
Yeah,
correct.
Whereas if the estate distributes money to a non-resident alien. Now, on income, there may be some withholding, but the IRS is not going to be expecting a tax return.
Yes.
From that beneficiary.
Yes, I think that's right.
On the U.S. side, I think it might actually be easier as a non-resident alien, especially if you are non-compliant.
Right.
But on the French side, it's not easier because France will take a bigger chunk or a chunk of that money.
Yeah, and it is always important to consider the tax rules of the country that you're living in, which U.S. tax professionals totally ignore.
Yeah. Well, I think a good model for anybody listening, we would take a look at the U.S.-Ireland tax treaty that talks about this. Ireland has inheritance taxes. And at the risk of oversimplification, I haven't looked at this recently, so I may not be exactly right in saying this. What I think the situation is that for U.S. citizens resident in Ireland will avoid inheritance tax on bequests from the United States. That's an example where Karen is absolutely right, that you've got to look at the tax situation in the country where you live. And, you know, France, again, is another example of that. And that is, I think a motivation for somebody like David to keep U.S. citizenship.
Can I just add on to this little discussion? In my experience, when I've looked around for information, different expat tax forms and so forth, I've gotten the clear sense that most tax professionals dealing with U.S. citizens abroad don't think to look at the treaties. And in the case of, especially in the case of people who are disabled who have non-working income, that leads to people paying extra tax that they shouldn't owe based on treaties. And it leads to a fundamental question of fairness, which is since the professionals, they don't know where to look, and the U.S. System treats non-working income much more punitively than equivalent U.S. source income. Should it even be necessary for people to have recourse to treaty provisions in order to get some relief?
Well, it's a terrible thing. It's a terribly complicated thing. The treaties are different. So, I mean, if somebody were to come and, call me on the phone and say, "Hey, John, I'm going to live outside the United States. How am I going to be taxed?" I'd say, "Hey, I don't have the vaguest idea. It depends where you're going, right? You know, what your income is and how the treaties work." So, that in itself is, I think, a tremendous element of unfairness. But another point I would make here is that, David, you said that you were talking about, U.S. tax forms. So I presume that these are tax preparers who are U.S.-centric or live in the United States. And my advice to people would be, unless they have the most simple situation imaginable, would be to use a tax professional who lives and works in the country where they live and understands their local tax system and therefore is much more likely to have read and understood the tax treaty.
I agree with that, but the ones that I'm thinking of who post repeatedly are actually based outside of the U.S. And for whatever reason, they respond to people who live in other countries. But so it's not just a U.S.-based problem. It's really a large portion of the tax professional base that just does not look or does not think to look at the treaty provisions outside of whatever country or the treaty provisions at all.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right on that, David, 100% right. And there are plenty of instances where these treaties can be tremendously helpful.
Would you say, John, that and I'm going to make a blanket statement here just to see if you agree or not. Would you say that the majority of U.S. tax compliance professionals really don't go into the detail of those treaties, that they just think within the confines of the American law when it comes to taxation and that's it, that it's really, you know, hard to find somebody who is really going to do what David just described?
You know, on the level of the sort of the $500 return, the mass market preparers, yeah, I think that's true. But I'm not sure that means they necessarily pay more U.S. tax. Maybe they pay less. I live in Toronto, Canada, which probably has the best concentration of, you know, people who technically understand this stuff. So, you know, they would understand the treaties, but you're paying a lot for that. I don't think that, you know, here's a dangerous statement, but I think it's mostly true. Unless you're prepared to pay a lot of money, I don't think that you're going to get a really, really good job done on U.S. taxes.
Can I just piggyback on that again, John? Because I don't think we're getting the sense of what kind of practical damage that bad advice can do. So for somebody in my position, you know, similar to my position, with disability income or welfare or unemployment, somebody who doesn't have much taxable income, but like the U.S., if they were living in the U.S., the same income, if it was U.S. source, say Social Security, would be either tax exempt or it would have some sort of tax relief. But if there's no treaty provision, or if your advisor or you aren't aware of a treaty provision, then you can end up owing several hundred or a couple thousand dollars of tax to the U.S. when you don't own any in your own country, who's following similar guidelines to the U.S. Has for U.S. residents. So you're talking about people who make somewhere between $12,000 and $30,000 a year, and who end up having to pay either preparer's fees or preparer's fees and tax that they wouldn't owe if they were living in the U.S. And that creates a huge hardship for people if they actually do follow the law, U.S. tax law, and continue filing. My guess is that a lot of people choose in that situation because it would present such a hardship to just not comply. But if those people did comply, it can create a huge hardship.
Yeah, David, you know, you're absolutely right on this. What I haven't said in this call, but I always do, and this is the right moment to do it, is this. The simple fact of the matter is that the United States is imposing a separate kind of tax system on Americans abroad. It's far more punitive because all the income in their whole lives are foreign. And, you know, and when they owe tax, it can be large amounts of tax. I mean, you know, you're talking about a few hundred dollars. Let's go back to the transition tax of 2017. I mean, I was aware of all kinds of people who owed hundreds of thousands of dollars of U.S. tax when there was no tax owing in their country of residence. So there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that people are victimized by bad advisors, you know, who can't see far enough down the road, don't understand the stuff well enough, et cetera, et cetera. So that certainly, you know, compounds and aggravates what's already a very, very bad situation. But let's get practical here a little bit, okay? We've been kind of introducing the enormity of the problem here. So Keith was talking about, you know, whether people should come into the system, not come into the system. I think we've given examples where it might be worth it, it might not be worth it, you know, et cetera. And then there's the issue of the renunciation. Should they renounce? Should they renounce filing, not filing, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, there's a range of options on the table. You know, I must say, okay, because it's just part of the discussion, okay, recognizing that, you know, there are these laws that people are expected to comply with. Realistically, there are a lot of people who, as David has pointed out, cannot comply because it's far too complex to do so and expensive, and there are others who choose not to comply. But one question that I'd like to start with this, okay, leaving aside whether somebody should be forced to renounce U.S. citizenship or not, I think that U.S. citizenship is a clear and present danger to people who don't live in the United States. Would you agree, disagree? What are your thoughts on that?
It certainly inhibits one living a normal life in their country of residence. Absolutely.
Karen, can you elaborate on that?
So, I think some of the more difficult people that I talk to are people in the most difficult situation, are those who had no idea that the U.S. required this or that they were subject to this and were living a normal life here in Australia. They had a self-managed super fund, or they were running their own small business through a family trust. And then they go to a U.S. tax compliance person who tries to fit all of this Australian stuff into U.S. boxes, and it just doesn't fit, and it doesn't fit easily. And they've got huge compliance bills and huge tax bills in some cases on stuff that they've all that's already been fully taxed in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think that for people who just have a salary and that's it, I think the compliance is probably manageable. But for anybody who tries to do normal financial planning, retirement planning in their country of residence, they're going to have a huge problem.
Australians have no choice.
Superannuation
is mandatory.
Superannuation is mandatory. So they've got this foreign retirement account, and what is it? Even the IRS doesn't know. So how can anyone be expected to get that right? Because nobody knows what right is.
Well, particularly given that there are different kinds of superannuations, right? I mean, I'm not sure the same rules apply to all of them.
That's right.
Can I make a blanket statement about non-working income, John, since we're on the topic?
So
if you have a salaried income and you're working abroad, there's the foreign earned income exclusion up to $100,000. And that's only for if it's for the year prior. So if you have any back pay, that doesn't count. But in a nutshell, the U.S. tax system as currently set up, any benefit that you get from the foreign earned income exclusion, if you live abroad for more than a few years, is more than clawed back by the extra taxation that you get from non-work income. So retirement savings, pensions, superannuation, disability, unemployment, welfare, whatever it is. And since people are living in the U.S., according to the Federal Voting Assistance Program, U.S. citizens who live abroad have been living abroad for 15 years or so. They're all going to have these sorts of non-working income. So in a nutshell, it was the U.S. tax system currently claws back far more than the foreign earned income exclusion. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I've never heard it put quite that way, partly because I'm not sure that I really view the foreign earned income exclusion to be a great advantage. I mean, unless you're living in the UAE or something like that. But let me say this. There is no doubt, okay, that the separate and punitive taxation that the U.S. imposes on non-U.S. income streams is atrocious, makes life unlivable, and makes it impossible for people to do reasonable financial planning because the U.S. mostly is imposing taxation on things that are tax deferred in other countries.
Not just tax deferred things, because you look at the PFIC rules, And it's ridiculous. You've got, you know, investments that pay the income out every year, just like U.S. investments do. And the U.S. is treating them as instruments of tax deferral and taxing them punitively.
You know, Karen, is it the U.S. or is it the tax compliance industry? You know, for years and years, the IRS never made any statement on this. But yet, these tax compliance people seem to think that foreign mutual funds are peoples.
Well, and now the IRS does too. The tax compliance industry has convinced them.
Well, of course, the IRS relies on the tax compliance industry. I mean, you know, to, you know, figure out what the worst, most punitive interpretation is, and then they do, and then they just follow it. You know, I really doubt that people with just garden variety mutual funds in Canada or the UK or wherever, you know, if they just treated the income as interest or dividends, capital gains, I don't think that anything would happen to them. You know,
well, I know people who are doing that, but if the IRS ever figures, you know, audits them, they might very well change.
Yeah. Maybe it's the uncertainty of the thing, right?
It is. It's the uncertainty.
All right. So back to it's the uncertainty, right, that's causing people to want to get out, basically, right? Because they can't even put together a clear route around the problems. Now, so in September, the IRS came out with this relief procedures for foreign citizens or for former citizens. And, you know, it was very, very interesting because when they described it, they made it very, very clear that there were all kinds of people who were renouncing and were not filing U.S. taxes. I mean, this comes directly from the IRS. I mean, everybody knew this is true anyway, but the IRS recognized this. So obviously, you know, people are renouncing U.S. citizenship without coming into tax compliance. Keith, what is your view of that?
Yeah, no, it was brought to their attention by a number of different avenues, including the Netherlands and in France, and because of the work that Fabien Mahogre had done with his association. So they realized that, and also through the Social Security Administration as well. So they realized that there's an issue. And what do you do with these people who have renounced and have not have not satisfied their U.S. tax declarations? So I think I would call it, and I don't know what you guys would call it, there's a certain, and I hate to use this term because it's too strong, but there's a certain quote-unquote amnesty that's been given to certain people who have renounced without satisfying their U.S. tax declaration based on specific criteria.
Or intend to renounce, right? It's a prospective program as well.
And that's a question, John. And you can help me with this. Is it a prospective program, or is it a program that you do after you get your certificate of loss of nationality?
No, it's only available to you after you have your certificate of loss of nationality, but you can make the decision to renounce in the future and use the program. In other words, it's not just for people, you know. And then, you know, and that's the real value of the program. But, you know, to be clear, okay, the requirements of the program are that you have to have an expatriating act after March 18th, 2010, which is the day FATCA came into force. You have to have a net worth below $2 million U.S. dollars, both on the day you renounce and on the day you file. And you cannot have more than $25,000 of U.S. tax owing over the six-year period for which you're filing. You know, those are the three biggies.
And also that you have never been in the U.S. tax system any time in your life.
Right, exactly. And you do not have to have a Social Security number either.
So isn't this just a big admission by the IRS that they cannot enforce U.S. tax law on people who have renounced?
Maybe.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, it's interesting that they are forgiving up to $25,000 of tax. I don't see any authorization for that in the Internal Revenue Code. You know, they just seem to have made that up. All right. But, I mean, we know, all of us know, the IRS knows, God knows they know, they confirmed in writing that all kinds of people have renounced without filing U.S. taxes or without filing a final U.S. tax return, the exit tax return, the 8854. So, Keith,
they also know that it's very, very complex, because if you look at their FAQs, they're saying, oh, well, just make your best effort, and even if you miss some things, we don't care.
Right.
I think that's right. And this, of course, Karen, is the only place I have ever seen the IRS combine the word PFIC with foreign mutual fund. But anyway, so one of the questions that, you know, Keith is forever asking, which means that he must be forever getting that question, is, you know, does it make sense for people to renounce? Well, I guess the first question, does it make sense for people to renounce? And then I guess a second question would be, does it make sense for people to renounce and use that program, you know, to come into tax compliance? So why don't we do them in order? We've talked a bit around the question, does it make sense for people to renounce? But why don't I ask the question directly and we'll get some direct answers. Does it at this point make sense for people to renounce U.S. citizenship? Shall we start? I'm just looking at my screen. We'll start with Karen.
Well, you know, you're talking to the one person on the call who has done such a thing. And I think it does make sense, because I think it eliminates uncertainty. You know, it's certainly not the answer for everyone, but for those who do not plan on ever living in the U.S. again, don't need the ability to live in the U.S., you know, and there's a few other things that, like if you're reliant on Social Security income, it makes no sense to renounce, depending on where you live again. You know, for a lot of people, it resolves the uncertainty, gets the bank off your back, and, allows you to plan for your retirement just like your neighbors are.
Yeah, and I guess for people who are thinking about renouncing, there's the specter of being a covered expatriate and subject to the exit tax. And, you know, it's interesting in these relief procedures, right? You have to have a net worth below $2 million, because if you had a net worth of $2 million or more, then you would be subject to the exit tax. So to me, that would suggest that those whose net worths are below $2 million might want to consider, if they're going to renounce pretty quickly. Would that make sense to you?
Yes,
I mean,
does.
If you're going to renounce, you might as well do it quickly, right, regardless of your net worth, because that cuts off the pain from that point forward.
It does. But for many people, they're going to become covered expatriates just through inflation, right?
Right, right. So best to try and renounce before you become a covered expatriate. And it's not just inflation. As you're saving for your retirement, your net worth goes up to where it will peak around the time you retire. So people who are, you know, over 50 up to 70 in that area, that would be the time of their highest lifetime assets. And yeah, you know, if you're fortunate enough that that's going to be over $2 million, then you're going to want to try and renounce before you hit the threshold. If
that's a big factor. Laura, what about you? What are your thoughts on the renunciation? Or Keith, sorry.
No, go ahead, Laura, please.
Oh, okay, well, I'm obviously, for some people, it makes sense to renounce. I won't duplicate what Karen said, but I would add that I'm thinking about the survey and the responses that people gave, and there were people who announced who were quite happy to have done so, and they said they, you know, never regretted it. So clearly for them, it made sense. I think it's a very, very personal decision, And just because it's the right decision for one person does not mean it's the right decision for another person.
Right. And I think it's extremely important to come back to what David was talking about, this whole treaty business. I think it's very, very important to be clear on what your tax situation would be after renunciation for people who have U.S. income streams.
Or a possible inheritance or something.
Yeah,
or
a inheritance. Yeah, I mean, I think that
from the U.S.
They need a higher level of analysis. Keith, what do you think? Should people renounce?
I have to concur with Karen and Laura on that one, but I will add one other thing, and I think it's important to note because sometimes this is not stated. It certainly is stated by you, John. Is that for people who may be considered a covered expatriate, they may fall into a particular bucket where they may not have to pay any type of exit tax if they meet certain criteria of being a dual citizen from birth and they move back to their one of the countries of their citizenship, like the France or the UK. So I think that's something to just throw into that mix, meaning that all hope is not lost that you're going to lose your shirt if you happen to be a covered expatriate, provided that you have this fall into that bucket of dual citizenship and then some other criteria behind that.
Yeah, exactly. The people the United States punishes most are the people who would be American only. All right. So I think.
But the other thing to note is that being a covered expatriate doesn't necessarily mean you owe a lot of tax. It really depends on what your assets are. And
okay,
whether there are capital gains that you can exclude. And I mean, it's a very individual thing. And if you're above the 2 million threshold, you need to spend a lot of time and money doing the analysis before you renounce.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And on that point, in my world, the world where I deal most are people with very high pensions. For covered expatriates, the pension is taxed extremely, extremely punitively as full income inclusion. But the point is that those who are considering renunciation, I think would be well advised to get some decent advice in this area.
John?
Yeah?
John, I know you wanted to keep things practical, but I'd like to add something. Even if in any one particular person's case, it's the right thing to renounce. I don't think that any renunciation is something to celebrate. I think it's something to mourn. And I think it's a really sad reflection on what the United States is as a country, that people are in that position. A very sad reflection. That's just what I wanted to add.
Well, Laura, I mean, you're 100% right. You're 1,000% right. The reality is here that U.S. citizenship is probably the only citizenship in the world that's worth renouncing, for a large number of people, because there's no other country that treats, that has this, this peculiar tax system. And I mean, I agree with you, Laura, but a lot of people have got to escape this. I have friends whose families escaped from, certain European countries in World War II who literally escaped, the middle of the night sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I know a few of them. And, for a lot of Americans abroad, it's now the same thing. In the sense their assets are being confiscated, that's what the transition tax is about. It really depends. I don't think it's something to be celebrated as a general principle, but I can tell you that for an awful lot of people, it's the best thing they can do.
I don't disagree.
Yeah. All right. Now, so we're talking about these people. Let's say they have the opportunity to use the relief procedures, or they could use streamlined or something like that. I'll start off commenting in this way. The relief procedures, I think, if you qualify, make it possible to manage the tax compliance thing much more easily. It's much easier than the streamline, which we'll talk about separately. But, you know, to anticipate Keith's question here, if people are renouncing without coming into tax compliance, why would somebody renounce and use the relief procedures to come into tax compliance? What would be the reasons for that? Karen, what are your thoughts on that?
It may be that people just want some certainty. They want to fully close that chapter of their lives and make sure it can't come back to bite them. Mm-hmm. Or they might be expecting, a possibility of having U.S. income in the future and not want to be raising any questions with the IRS about why they're no longer a citizen.
So renunciation, for those who aren't clear on this, is a loss of U.S. citizenship for nationality purposes. It is also a loss of U.S. citizenship for tax purposes, but renunciation can trigger tax consequences. So for a lot of people, to use, say, the relief procedures, some other way of coming to tax compliance, is to seal off all ports of entry of problems. You know, whether they do it or not, you know, is a different question. But that is, from a legal point of view, what they would need, I think, to seal off all issues. I think Karen makes a very, very important statement. I can't remember the word you used, but I think the point is simply that they don't want to think about this. They want certainty, right?
Right. They want to cut off any chance of the IRS ever coming back to talk to them.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, I mean, I'm not saying that it's pain-free. Nothing to do with the U.S. tax system is pain-free, but it's a relatively inexpensive way to do that for that group of people. Does anybody disagree with that?
The relief procedures? Yeah, they don't require an awful lot if you fall into their criteria of net worth less than $2 million,
right,
and U.S. tax liability of less than $25,000 over a 5-year period.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people would probably see it that way. Keith, what are your views on it?
I would have to concur with what Karen just said. I don't have anything on this particular question to add, in all honesty.
So you would generally encourage people who renounce and are eligible for the relief procedures to take advantage of them, or you would not?
I think, well, if they meet the criteria, and they don't, you know, because there is a, you know, there is a ceiling of the $2 million, correct? So
right.
if they meet the criteria, that could be a good thing to put a full stop or a period at the end. Now, like with everything is not clear cut. What if you have somebody who has assets over that $2 million mark? Okay.
Well, then they don't qualify. They can't use it.
Right, exactly. Well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
Well, they can't do the relief procedures, but they let's imagine they're a dual citizen from birth, and therefore
then
they're tax compliant for 5 years.
Right.
They wouldn't be subject to the exit tax under those circumstances. Then they could do a streamline, couldn't they?
Right. And I think it depends on the individual.
Yes, how about yes, they could. Yeah, they could.
Yes, they could. It really depends on how complex their financial system is.
Right.
Situation is, and how important it is to them to have the closure, because that's
exactly.
An individual question as well. For some people,
right.
It's like they don't care. The U.S. can't hurt them, or they don't think the U.S. can hurt them. They're not going to spend a cent fixing it because they don't see the point. But then for a lot of other people, and probably the majority, the certainty is worth something. And worth the cost of the compliance.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I've dealt with people where, you know, there's some, they just don't care. They're just getting the CLN and that's it. They don't care. But you do have
right.
others, and it depends on their personality, that they know darn well they're just not going to be able to sleep at night. It's always going to be something that's going to be gnawing at them. And so right. now they have this particular program that could just put a period at the end.
Yeah, fairly easily and fairly inexpensively relative to what was available before the relief provision.
Right.
Yeah. One point I like to make here, okay, and I made this to you yesterday, Keith, when you were talking about this call. When problems with the U.S. tax system start, I don't think there's such a thing as a small problem. They can quickly escalate. And, you know, what I've seen.
Especially if you've got anything international that requires an information return, yeah. where it's like $10,000 per form that they want to penalize
yeah.
you.
And yeah. so I'm going to offer my opinion on this, which probably will not be popular, but it is my opinion. And it's this, that I've seen so many people really damaged by this, okay? That when I look at people who can get out of this very easily, you know, I think they should. It's probably, if they're not going to live in the United States, the best single investment they can make in their future. That's basically what I think on it. The problem with this is that it's a very relative thing. If you don't have a lot of money, even a small amount of money to come into compliance is a lot of money. But if you get to the point where through inflation, you know, all you have to do is own a house in a major city, you know, you become a covered expatriate, then you will be wishing for the days that you could have walked through the door and been done with this. Because I don't think it's good. I don't think it's really possible for people to file U.S. tax returns the rest of their life if they're not going to live in the United States. It's expensive. It's complicated. It's penalty laden. The laws are subject to change. Just look at the whole transition tax and GILTI stuff, for example.
Look at the exit tax. I mean, the exit tax didn't exist when I became an Australian citizen.
That's right.
Right.
So my message on it would be, take a look at your situation. If you're in a situation where you can get out now very easily, I think you should give that very serious consideration. Because times can change very easily. Before we wrap this up, one of the things that Keith is always asking about is the difference between, say, the streamline program and the relief procedures. Should we talk about that a bit?
Yeah, you know, because I do get questions of someone, you know, whether they should do the stream, you know, let's say they meet the criteria of the relief program, okay? But they still have the question, should they do the streamlined and get their their CLN, their Certificate of Lost Nationality, or should they do the new relief program and do it that way?
Absolutely, new relief program if they're eligible. Absolutely. You know, they don't need a Social Security number for it. They're going to forgive 25,000 of U.S. tax.
Right.
I mean, what would be the reason for doing the streamlined in those circumstances?
Well, let me throw something out there, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Let's say that particular individual, okay, who meets the criteria. I guess the person that would have to do the streamline is someone who has a business, a small to medium-sized business, correct?
Not necessarily. It would depend.
It depends on what tax liability it throws off in the U.S.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The person who has to do the streamline is the person who either has assets over 2 million or has filed a U.S. tax return, has filed a 1040 in the past, or has tax liability above the 25,000. Now, there are a lot of people for whom that's available, and that makes sense. At the present time, they're not asserting penalties under streamlined, which is good. So that's an option as well. But the I really am inclined to think that for those who've made the decision that they want to do the tax thing to seal off all the ports of anxiety, I think the relief procedures is a good program, provided that you can fit yourself in it. Good in the sense that it's better than all of the other options out there.
Right.
See, let's look at it this way, okay? Really, the streamlined procedures are for people who want to come into compliance. They were really designed for people to come into compliance, live as a compliant American, stay in compliance. They aren't always used for that purpose, but that's what they were intended for. The relief procedures are actually the exact opposite. You know, they're for people who've renounced U.S. citizenship, and it's just a tax cleanup, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But then, as you know, once you use the streamline to come into compliance, you're going to realize very quickly that maintaining compliance is more onerous than it sounds.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. That is absolutely correct. So many people just come into compliance because they imagine the U.S. tax system is the same as the system they're familiar with, right?
They imagine it's rational.
Yeah, well, they imagine it's rational. You know, that they imagine it generally
it
works
makes sense.
The same way. And they imagine that, you know, if they pay tax in Australia or France, they won't pay in the U.S. What happens to a lot of people is that they'll come into the system through streamlined and they will over comply in the sense that if there's any doubt about whether an information return has to be filed, they'll file that information return and they set up a situation where continued compliance is practically impossible. You know, it's so onerous. And by coming into compliance, this is so interesting, by coming into compliance, they've planted the seeds of their renunciation because they can't continue it.
Right.
Tragic, tragic, tragic. Right, Laura?
Yes, as I said before, any renunciation is a cause for mourning.
Yeah, especially the ones though who tried so hard to comply, especially them.
Yeah.
Well, we've been at this for a while. This has been a very, very interesting discussion.
It has.
What would be everybody's closing thoughts here? David, closing thoughts?
I think we've covered pretty much everything that I had in mind. I guess maybe just to, because we were talking about the renunciations, I said earlier that I, you know, certainly wouldn't consider it, but given the difficulty that I raised of, you know, having to choose between a potential recovery of working again and complying with the U.S. tax filing requirements. I mean, I spend a year doing nothing else. If, you know, if the law changes or if the banking issues get more difficult and I acquire French citizenship at some point, then my thinking may change and say, okay, you know, it's just not worth keeping the U.S. citizenship anymore if I have, you know, if I have to deal with all of that.
Yeah,
there are other things in life.
Yes,
and
I
will say, you know, right now that if I do renounce, it will be because I feel that I'm forced to do so.
Yeah, Laura, something to add?
Well, I would say that the discussions on this topic usually go back and forth between two impossible choices, two very difficult choices. Either try and comply on a long-term basis, which for all the reasons you've explained and we've discussed is very, very difficult, if not impossible for most people, or renounce. And my response to that is we shouldn't simply accept that those are our only two choices. We do have a third choice, which is what everyone on this podcast, together with other people, have been doing, which is to fight to get the laws changed so that we're not faced with these two impossible decisions. And so that's what I would say to anyone listening to this podcast. If you are like me, and I think a lot of other people, that you don't like those two choices and you don't want either of those two choices, you do have a third choice, which is join those that are working to get the laws changed.
Okay. Aaron?
Yeah, I think what we've highlighted today is that it's not one size fits all, that there's lots of moving parts to anyone's tax situation, no matter how simple they think it is, and that the correct answer is going to be different for every person, depending not only on their financial situation, but also their personality, how important it is to them to retain the U.S. citizenship, what their plans are in the future in terms of possibly living in the U.S. again. There's so many factors that you can't find, one website that's going to give you all the answers. Can't find one podcast that's going to give you all the answers. You've just got to figure it all out for your own situation and where you personally are on all of these issues.
Yeah, makes sense. Keith?
I'm going to add on to what Karen stated. Absolutely, because there are a number of gears and levers that need to be adjusted and tried to see what is going to be the best fit for you as an American overseas or an accidental American. My overarching theme that I always say to people is breathe, think first. Don't make any rash decisions. Take the time, do your investigation, do it from a holistic approach. Speak with people who have gone through this, whether they've renounced or entered the system and stayed in the system, who are not in the system. It's important to gather as much information as possible. And using people who, for example, are on this podcast is a very good start to just gather the best information that you can before you take a decision.
Yeah, these are all great points. And I guess what I would say is this, that in life, one of the reasons that we call something a decision is because the answer is not 100% clear. If it were 100% clear, then no decision at all would be required. So I do think this is a decision, and I think it's very, very difficult for people for, the reasons that we've given. But I will add this, that, you can still identify as being an American even if you renounce. And
yes.
I guess what I would also say is that there's a difference between being a U.S. citizen and having a life. And to the extent that being a U.S. citizen is interfering with your having a life, that I think is something that you really ought to consider. In any case, thank you very much, all of you, for participating in this today. This has been an incredibly interesting discussion. And I do hope that it helps somebody down the road listening to this. So wherever you are in the world, Toronto, Canada, Brisbane, Australia, two from Paris, and Keith, right down there, Washington, D.C.
And the nation's capital temporarily.
Are you in front of U.S. Treasury talking to us?
We're under a lockdown.
You're under, including Treasury. All right. Anyway, yeah. This is great. So we'll pick this up again at some point. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.